Hikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Hikatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something absolutely fundamental. Memory. How it works, how we learn, everything.
Mm-hmm. But maybe not in the way most people think about it. We're not talking about, you know, tricks for memorizing lists.
No, exactly. We're diving into some breakthrough science, really, from Fergus Craik and Larry Jacoby. Their work suggests a lot of common study habits. They might be, well, fundamentally off track.
It's a big claim, but their research really backs it up. We're unpacking this idea that memory isn't like a passive storage unit, not a video recorder.
Right. That's the core misunderstanding, isn't it? Thinking your brain just records things or you pull facts out of some mental filing cabinet. If you think that way, you're missing the active part.
And that's why this matters. If you misunderstand the mechanism, you can't really optimize how you use your brain for learning, for remembering, even for understanding yourself.
So our goal here is to explore their view.
Yeah.
Memory as this dynamic, active, constantly rebuilding process. It's about the cognitive actions you take.
Yes. And once you grasp that, it gives you, the listener, a sense of agency. You can actually improve how you learn and recall. It's quite empowering.
Okay, let's get into the thinkers behind this shift. First, Fergus Craik, Scottish-Canadian professor, big name. What's his cornerstone contribution?
Well, Craik, working with Robert Lockhart back in the 70s, came up with the levels of processing theory, or LOP. As it's known.
LOP. Okay.
Before LOP, the thinking was often quite linear. You know, information goes from sensory input, maybe to short-term memory, then hopefully into long-term storage, like compartments.
Uh-huh. Like fixed boxes.
Exactly. Craik and Lockhart said, wait a minute, maybe those boxes aren't the most important part. Maybe it's about what you do with the information.
The quality of the thinking itself.
Precisely. LOP argues that how well you remember something, how durable that memory is, doesn't just depend on how long you look at it or how many times you repeat it. It depends on the depth of the cognitive processing you apply.
So thinking about the meaning, connecting it, that's deep.
That's deep. Semantic processing, understanding the meaning, relating it to other things you know, that creates a strong, lasting trace. Whereas just looking at, say, the font size or the sound of a word.
This shallow. And fleeting.
Very fleeting. It was a fundamental shift away from structure towards process.
Huge. Okay, now let's bring in his collaborator, Larry Jacoby, Washington University. He looks at it from a slightly different angle, right? Retrieval.
Yeah, Jacoby's work often focuses on this fascinating split in memory, the difference between implicit, sort of automatic unconscious memory and explicit conscious controlled recall. He developed some really clever methods like the process dissociation procedure or PDP.
PDP. What did that let him do?
It allowed researchers to actually tease apart why someone responded a certain way. Was it because they consciously remembered seeing something before, or was it just this automatic gut feeling of familiarity kicking in?
That feeling. I know I've seen that name before.
Exactly. And that leads directly to his famous becoming famous overnight experiment, which sounds like, you know, a pop psychology gimmick, but it's serious science.
What did it show? How does that work?
It demonstrated how easily that automatic familiarity can mislead you.
Yeah.
Basically, participants would read a list of non-famous names. Later, they're shown a mix of famous names, old non-famous names, and new non-famous names, and asked to identify the famous ones.
Okay.
What happens is some of those old non-famous names just feel familiar from the first reading. And because the participants can't consciously place why they feel familiar, they misattribute that feeling.
To fame. They think, oh, that name rings a bell, must be someone famous.
Precisely. You mistake that faint echo, that whisper from the past, for genuine recognition. It shows how unreliable that feeling of knowing can be sometimes.
Wow. So Craik gives us the importance of deep processing for getting information in, and Jacoby highlights the complexities and potential pitfalls of getting it back out, especially that automatic familiarity versus conscious recall.
It's a really powerful combination. It provides a much more complete picture of how memory actually functions, encoding and retrieval.
So let's dive into the book's main arguments. You said it rejects the single store idea.
Definitely. The central idea is that memory isn't one monolithic thing. It's a complex architecture. You've got different systems working together, episodic for events, semantic for facts, procedural for skills, like riding a bike. They're distinct, but interconnected.
And memory itself isn't the event, but what's left behind?
The residual trace, as they put it. It's the footprint left by the cognitive processes you engaged in during the experience. Perception, attention, thought.
So if I wasn't paying much attention, the footprint is faint.
Exactly. If you were distracted while reading something complex, you performed shallow operations. The memory trace reflects that shallow input. It's not a system failure. It's a direct consequence of how you interacted with the information.
I really like how they reframe memory failures. Forgetting things, getting details wrong, it's not necessarily a bug.
Often, no. They argue it's an adaptive feature. Our memory system is optimized for efficiency and relevance, not for perfect, high-fidelity recording of every single detail. It needs to generalize to be flexible.
So it's designed for reconstruction, not perfect playback.
That's a great way to put it, which leads us nicely into the different parts of the system. We need to go beyond just short-term and long-term.
Right, you mentioned working memory. That's more active.
Much more active. Think of it as your mental workbench or scratch pad. It's where you hold information temporarily and manipulate it. It's crucial for thinking, problem solving, and importantly, for that initial encoding phase.
Okay, and encoding brings us right back to Craig's big idea.
Levels of processing. Yes, this is probably the most actionable concept for anyone listening. You have to understand the difference between shallow and deep processing if you want to improve your memory.
Give us the everyday difference. What's shallow? What's deep?
Okay, shallow processing is focusing on surface features, like noticing the font style of a word, or maybe its sound, does it rhyme with another word, or simply repeating a phone number over and over without thinking about the digits.
Just rote repetition.
Right. Deep processing, on the other hand, is all about meaning. Semantic processing. Asking questions like, what does this actually mean? How does it connect to things I already know? Can I put this in my own words? How is it similar to or different from related concepts?
So engaging with the substance.
That's it. That deeper engagement, wrestling with the meaning, that's what creates a durable, long-lasting memory trace. Shallow processing leads to fragile memories that fade quickly.
Okay, so building on LOP, the book talks about forming really strong memories. Chapter 4, I think. What are the key principles there?
Two big ones they highlight are elaboration and distinctiveness.
Elaboration and distinctiveness.
Elaboration is about enriching the memory trace. It's linking the new information to your existing knowledge network, creating more connections, more pathways to that memory, like weaving it into a richer tapestry, not just leaving it as a single thread.
Making it meaningful by connecting it. What about distinctiveness?
Distinctiveness is about making that memory trace stand out from others. What makes this particular piece of information unique or different? Highlighting that uniqueness makes it easier to pick out later during retrieval. Less interference from similar memories.
Makes sense. And there's one technique that seems to hit both of those. The self-reference effect. That seems incredibly powerful.
Oh, it's hugely powerful. It's arguably the most effective form of deep, elaborative, and distinctive processing. When you actively relate information to yourself, to your own life, experiences, goals.
Like, how could I use this idea? Or does this remind me of something I experienced?
Exactly. You're automatically engaging deeply with the meaning. You're connecting it to the richest knowledge structure you have, your knowledge about yourself. And you're making it inherently distinctive and personally relevant. It's a fantastic shortcut to strong encoding.
So that shifts learning from just passively absorbing stuff to actively making it yours. But okay, we've encoded it deeply. Now we need to get it back out. Chapter 5 moves to retrieval, right? Why do we sometimes blank, even when we know we know it?
Yes, retrieval. This is where Endel Tolving's encoding specificity principle comes in. It's a cornerstone idea.
Encoding specificity, what does that mean?
It basically says that your ability to retrieve a memory depends heavily on the overlap between the conditions or cues present at retrieval and the conditions or cues present when you originally encoded it.
The context matters.
Hugely. Context isn't just the background. It gets woven into the memory trace itself. So the classic example is environmental context. If you learn something underwater, you'll likely recall it better underwater than on land.
Or my studying in the coffee shop example, the quiet test room feels different. Fewer cues match.
Precisely. The smell of coffee, the background chatter, even your internal state like your mood. Those can all become part of the encoded memory. If those cues aren't there when you try to retrieve, access is harder.
So retrieval isn't just pulling up a file. It's more like rebuilding, using current cues to find the old path.
It's an active reconstructive process. You're using available cues, including your current thoughts and environment, to piece the memory back together. It's not a simple playback.
Okay, but if it's reconstructive, does that mean our memories aren't entirely accurate? Are Craig and Jacoby suggesting our memories are kind of Fictionalized?
Well, fictionalized might be too strong, but they're definitely not perfect replicas. They argue this reconstruction is generally adaptive. Let's go back to Jacoby's work in Chapter 6 on fallibility. Remember the split between explicit controlled and implicit automatic systems.
Yeah, the conscious recall versus that automatic feeling of familiarity.
Right. Errors often happen when that automatic familiarity signal is strong, but we misinterpret why it's strong. We might misattribute the source, like in the false fame effect.
That gut feeling leading us astray.
It can. But the fact that memory is reconstructive, even though it leads to errors sometimes, like blending details from different events or updating old memories with new information, think Bartlett's War of the Ghosts study.
Where people's recall of a story changed over time to fit their own cultural understanding.
Exactly. That flexibility, that tendency to smooth things out, fill in gaps, make things coherent with our current understanding. It's actually incredibly useful. It allows us to generalize from past experiences, to solve new problems, to be creative.
So the brain is like an efficient editor, maybe.
Yeah.
Cutting unnecessary details, updating the narrative to keep it relevant for the present.
That's a brilliant analogy. It sacrifices perfect historical fidelity for present utility and coherence. It's optimizing for sense-making, not perfect data storage.
Okay, that makes the failures feel less like failures.
Yeah.
What about memory and aging? Chapters 7 and 8, is it just inevitable decline?
The book really challenges that simple narrative. Yes, some memory functions tend to decline with age, but Craik especially argues it's often not about a loss of the underlying capacity itself.
So what is declining then?
It's often a reduction in self-initiated, effortful, controlled processing. That deliberate, resource-intensive thinking needed for deep encoding and strategic retrieval. Older adults may rely more on automatic processes or struggle more when they have to generate retrieval cues themselves without support.
Ah, so it's more about the strategy or the available cognitive resources, maybe due to divided attention.
Often, yes. And the optimistic part is when you provide older adults with more environmental support, better cues, less distraction, tasks that guide the processing those age-related differences in memory performance often shrink significantly.
So the potential is still there, it just needs more scaffolding, perhaps?
Exactly. It suggests the underlying memory systems are largely intact, but accessing and utilizing them effectively requires more support or different strategies. It's not necessarily a total loss, more a shift in how the system operates optimally.
That's a much more hopeful perspective. Okay, let's try to boil this down. What are the main sort of philosophical shifts Craik and Jacoby push for? Key themes.
Okay, three big ones come to mind. First, definitely processing over storage.
The LOP idea again. What you do matters more than where it's stored.
Absolutely. The depth of your mental engagement is the primary driver of memory durability, not just time spent passively exposed to the information. That has huge implications for how you should study, prepare for meetings, learn anything, really.
Focus on meaning, connection, questioning, not just rereading. Okay, what's second?
Second is the adaptive nature of limitations.
Reframing forgetting and distortion.
Yes. Seeing forgetting, especially of irrelevant details, not as a system flaw, but as crucial for efficiency, and seeing the reconstructive nature, while prone to error, as vital for flexibility, generalization, and keeping our knowledge up to date, our memory serves our present goals.
It's built for navigating the future, not just archiving the past perfectly.
Right.
And third.
Third, context is king.
The encoding specificity principle.
Mm-hmm. Recognizing that memory is fundamentally context dependent. The environment, both external, like the room, and internal, like your mood or thoughts, gets bound to the memory trace. Retrieval works best when those contexts match.
Which implies maybe if you want to access information in lots of contexts, maybe you should study it in varied contexts.
That's one implication, yes. Creating more varied encoding cues might lead to more flexible retrieval later on. It underlines that memory isn't just in your head, it's an interaction between your brain and the world.
Okay, those are powerful themes. The book must have some memorable lines or concepts that really crystallize these ideas.
Oh, definitely. Let's pull out a few key ideas, maybe paraphrase slightly for clarity.
Great. What's one that speaks to study habits?
This one really cuts through the noise. The depth of processing during learning is a better predictor of memory performance than the amount of time spent studying.
Oof. Kills the all-nighter cram session based on just staring at notes. Quality over quantity.
Exactly. Then there's one challenging that computer metaphor we keep using. Memory retrieval is not like opening a file. It is a reconstructive process that can change the memory itself.
That's mind-bending. Accessing a memory can alter it.
It highlights the dynamic, malleable nature of memory, And here's one offering perhaps some comfort about forgetting. What we call memory failures are often the natural consequences of memory systems working as they are designed to work.
Takes the pressure off. It's the system optimizing, not breaking.
Right. And finally, Jacoby's crucial warning about that automatic feeling. The feeling of familiarity is a fast and effortless whisper from the past. The most profound errors occur when we mistake this whisper for the confident voice of true recollection.
Chilling, almost. That unconscious influence can really lead to mistakes in judgment if we're not careful about checking the source.
It underscores the need for critical thinking, even about our own internal experiences.
Okay, these ideas are fascinating, but how do we apply them? What should someone listening do differently tomorrow?
All right, practical tips. Educationally, the biggest one is ditch passive rereading. Seriously, embrace active learning strategies grounded in this research.
Like what specifically?
Focus on elaboration. Constantly ask yourself, how does this new idea relate to what I already know? How is it similar? How is it different? Can I explain this to someone else?
And the other big one?
The generation effect. Test yourself constantly. Don't just look at the answer. Try to retrieve it from your own memory first. That effortful retrieval practice is one of the most powerful ways to strengthen long-term memory. It is deep processing.
So self-testing isn't just assessment. It's actually a learning tool itself.
Possibly the best one we have. On a more personal level, understanding the reconstructive nature can genuinely help relationships.
How so?
Well, if you and a friend or a partner remember a shared event differently, which happens all the time, understanding reconstruction means you don't have to immediately jump to you're wrong or you're lying.
Right. It could just be two different brains focused on different aspects, encoding it differently, connecting it to different past experiences, and now reconstructing it based on those unique traces.
Exactly. It allows for a bit more grace. It's often just memory working as designed, shaped by individual perspectives, not necessarily malice or deliberate distortion.
That's actually really helpful. And for people concerned about memory as they age,
the focus should shift towards compensatory strategies. Don't just worry, adapt. Use external aids, calendars, notes, reminders. Structure your environment to provide consistent cues.
Minimize distractions.
Absolutely. Since effortful, controlled processing might be more resource limited, minimizing distractions helps you allocate those precious attentional resources effectively for deep encoding when you need it. It's about working with the system.
So managing resources, using tools, structuring the environment. Strategic compensation.
Yes. Rather than just feeling helpless about perceived decline.
This whole deep dive really reframes memory, doesn't it? It moves it from being this sort of fixed, mysterious thing you either have or don't,
to something you have significant influence over. That's the most vital takeaway, I think. You have more agency than you probably realize.
Memory as a skill.
Yes, a skill cultivated through mindful cognitive engagement. Through the quality of your thinking. It's not just a capacity you're born with. It's something you actively build and shape through how you interact with information.
That's incredibly empowering. Okay, so here's a final thought to leave our listeners with, spinning out from these ideas.
All right, let's hear it.
If memory is constantly reconstructing our past, weaving together bits and pieces to create a coherent story that makes sense now, what does that really mean for our sense of self, for our personal identity? Are you actually remembering the person you were objectively? Or is your memory constantly rewriting your autobiography to better fit the person you feel you are today? Are you remembering or are you reconstructing yourself?
Wow, that is quite the question to ponder. The implications of memory reconstruction for identity. A deep thought indeed.
Something to chew on.
Definitely.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by eCotra Foundation.